Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our podcast is brought to you today by our friends at 8 Sleep. And a quick reminder that you can subscribe to us anywhere they offer podcasts, Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And if I'm leaving somebody out, feel free to email me. Well, it is Friday, so we need to have a mega cast. And we are joined by Cyril Longwell and Andrew Egger of The Bulwark. We were kind of hoping to be joined by Bill Kristol, but he ghosted us, didn't he?
Ah, yes, a minier mega cast than we had been expecting.
I'm bringing this
too
up.
Too cool for school, man.
Well, okay, Sarah, because I'm bringing this up because remember, Bill and I made fun of you for being late, but you showed up.
Yeah, I was stuck in an elevator. I was genuinely stuck in an elevator that time.
Oh, no, come on. Really? Don't try
that
again.
Elevator, the one
no,
here,
we're not going to. Okay, so we're going to work up to talking about guns, doxing, white supremacy, and all of this. But could I just start with this? Because here's the good news. I worry that I lose my capacity to be shocked by anything. I worry that I've just become so numbed and so cynical that you're just going to turn on the podcast one day and I'm going to say, yeah, Trump, yada, yada, yada. Same old, okay? But today, like within the last half hour, I actually tweeted out WTF because I honestly believe that that story about bringing back the two-month-old orphan to the hospital so he could be in a photo op with the president. I thought this was a hoax. I thought it was fake news. There was no way that they brought that baby back to the hospital so that Donald Trump and Melania could pose with it in a thumbs-up picture. Okay, Sarah, you're the only mom here. I mean, what? I don't know how many times we've said there's no bottom, but that really was, I mean, you know, no matter how bad you thought that El Paso visit was, that picture, the fact that they brought that baby back was just stunning to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that's totally happened to me as I've become a parent is that all of these shootings take on a totally different hue. I feel it so much more. And that story in particular where you have just a two-month-old and the mother is trying to cover the baby with her body and the father is trying to cover them both and both the parents end up being killed and then now this baby is an orphan. It's one of these things where last weekend, right, we just all sat, or at least I did, in horror watching everything that happened with these shootings and feeling genuinely terrorized and heartbroken. And then to go into a week then where it just all becomes political football and I don't want to go all both sides here because it is, but it's just the way that it all becomes politics so quickly just feels so bad, especially when it doesn't feel like that politics is actually going to move us towards anything productive. But the way that the president has used the shootings for photo ops is particularly disgusting. That picture, I just sometimes don't know where, it's not even that there's no bottom. I just couldn't possibly understand what you might be thinking if you're him and Melania and you decide I'm going to stand there next to this newly orphaned baby and give a thumbs up sign.
I mean, a little bit of it, I think, is that it's just sort of that this is the dynamic that Trump feels like he has with people who are his supporters, right? And the, you know, the fact that this was all this took place, you know, in Texas, where there are a lot of Republicans. I believe I was reading that, you know, the other
less
people
than
who
people
are in
think.
That photo. Yeah. That's true. But the other people in that photo are sort of, I believe, were like the aunt and the uncle of that orphan baby. And you know, they're posing there too. And so Trump has this thing where like anytime he's interacting with interacting with his fans, it's sort of this, you know, this sort of grandiose, like I'm deigning to be around you sort of mentality. He really sort of gets off on the sort of adulation he gets from these people. What makes it so awful here is just the fact that he really seems to have no other gear other than that, even in these situations. And we've seen this, you know, when he's visited wounded veterans in hospitals and things like that, all of these things. I mean, his prevailing mood seems to be at all these times, like, well, obviously this bad thing happened to you, but now look on the bright side.
I am here.
Like, well, yeah, and it's just sort of ghoulish, right?
And they wouldn't allow the media to come in because they didn't want it to be a photo op, which I thought would be pretty good if there was any truth to it. And of course, then they produce basically this promotional video you know, about all the adulation, which was about as tasteless and crass as you could possibly imagine.
It was brutalistic. It was just horrible to watch.
And yesterday, I quoted, and I should have up front given more credit, because this is one of my favorite quotes. I remember hearing it as a kid. It's from Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who is Teddy Roosevelt's daughter. And she said this about Teddy, that Teddy always wanted to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, the baby at every christening. And I said, and Donald Trump obviously, you know, feels the same way, and he also wants to be the rock star at every trauma center. And this is part of the problem that I think that he has. So I mean, it's for anyone who thought that he was going to be the consoler in chief. Well, I don't even know what you were thinking. But also, how long ago does it seem that he gave that press conference or that those remarks on Monday, where you know he said the words, he did the incantation of the words denouncing white supremacy, and even as he was saying them, people are saying this is teleprompter Trump. Give it 24 hours. He's going to find a way to undo it. But even so, it was stunning watching him tweet out his attacks on Beto O'Rourke, or even at the hospital, talking about the size of Beto O'Rourke's crowds.
And it's so gratuitous. It serves absolutely no political purpose. You know, as though Beto is like an adversary of the president's who he has like a real political need to quash. Not that would make it any better, but it would maybe, you know, fit into the regular narratives that we have of the way Trump, you know, approaches his opponents and things like that, right? Where, oh, he's always going to hit back. He's always going to, you know, lay waste to anybody who's standing in his way. But I think what we saw yesterday with some of this stuff, specifically with the Beto stuff, where he's like, you know, at the hospital, he's supposedly there to sort of, you know, honor and comfort and respect these victims of this horrible tragedy. He's there popping off about how much better the mood in his room was than across town. But I mean, it's outrageous. It's unreal. It's like, well, what's happening? You know, I mean, like, what's this? You sort of run out of words to sort of talk about all of the ways in which it's the same bad thing.
I know, and that's why I'm worried about being numbed about all of this. Now, you know, I don't know how many times, Sarah, we've had this conversation, we generally as a nation, about, well, is this the tipping point? Is this the turning point? And of course, it never turns out to be. But it did occur to me this week that this week exposed the flaw in the Faustian bargain that a lot of conservatives and Republicans have made. And the Faustian bargain is, okay, we're going to look the other way, you know, when your boorishness, about your boorishness, your dishonesty, your lies, all of those things, as long as we get our judges and we get our tax cuts and all of that. I mean, that is the Faustian bargain. We get a lot of those things. But the flaw is that, well, what if you're talking about a president who is fomenting racist violence? What if you have a president who is giving oxygen to domestic terrorism? That obviously was never part of the bargain. That at least up until now, you know, that the butcher's bill has been pretty high, but it hasn't been that high, which is why there's so much effort invested in denying that the president is responsible. I have a piece at the Bulwark talking about Byron York's attempts to deny, no, really, you know, read that manifesto, he's got nothing to do with it. And Mark Tyson, who is, you know, writing in the Washington Post, that if you blame Trump, then you must blame the Democrats for Dayton. Because that is really the bridge too far. And that's, I get the sense that there are Republicans, even Republicans who were thinking when he was tweeting about the squad, and even with the, you know, send her back chant, we're going, well, at least, you know, that's going to, you know, solidify the base, that there's a real sense that, oh my God, this thing is getting out of hand, and we run the risk of really being wiped out among women, among independents, among moderates, and among suburban voters.
Yeah, there was a lot of strategic silence from that crowd this week. And I think part of it is that, you know, the shooting happened and it was this culmination of actually a couple really crazy weeks, starting with his, you know, go back to where you came from tweets, which then manifested into the send her back chants, which then turned into the crazy attacks on Elijah Cumming and Baltimore, which then led to him sort of gleefully, I mean, this was just last Friday, sort of gleefully celebrating the fact that Elijah Cumming's house was robbed. And then the shooting happens, and that never even really got a news cycle, because then the shootings happened sort of one on top of the other. But Republicans were already on their heels a little bit, saying, man, that is too much racism. And then the shootings are such a
that's too much racism.
Yeah, I mean,
we were willing to go for this much racism, but
there was right. We were it felt like we were already kind of at a tipping point, and then so that for there to be a white nationalist shooting that directly ties itself to Trump's rhetoric, you know, you spent the first part of the week with a lot of strategic silence. And then it was weird. It was sort of like about Wednesday you started to see like the editorials come out that were like, hey, don't blame Elizabeth Warren for the Dayton shooting the same way you shouldn't blame Trump for the El Paso shooting. And there was this real setup, like a strategic setup to sort of pit the Dayton shooting as sort of left-wing motivated and the El Paso one as right-wing motivated. But that is a false equivalency, because unless the Dayton shooter had a manifesto that said, you know, Elizabeth Warren, you know, this is because I hate capitalism and I am, you know, spurned to action by Elizabeth Warren's rhetoric. That's not what happened. He just happened to like Elizabeth Warren. That's different than something being politically motivated. It doesn't look like at this point politics had anything to do with his actual motivation of the shooting.
And he was,
which is different from that El Paso.
And he is sane, insane. I mean, that's there doesn't seem to be any question about that. That this is a guy who had a kill list and a rape list, and it was deeply, deeply troubled here.
Yeah, but I think anybody who does this, look, people kind of always single out like one thing or another. But anytime something like this happens, you're at a nexus of something, right? You're at the nexus of whatever the motivation is, plus mental instability, plus easy access to guns. And plus maybe radicalization from the internet. Like all of those things are coming together in some sort of perfect storm to create something like this. And so I think mental instability probably goes for both of them, but only one of them was actively politically motivated.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think that in terms of dealing with this is the problem with words like insane and nuts. You know, they actually ought to mean something. And, you know, insanity has the traditional legal meaning of not knowing the difference between right and wrong. Doesn't just simply mean having extreme views. And I do think that we need to confront white nationalism as a, you know, I won't say coherent ideology, but certainly an ideology, an identifiable ideology, an ideology that actually has an appeal to people across the globe. And we have to acknowledge all of that. And, mm-hmm. you know, and Byron York's position as well, he's also interested in environmental issues and corporate issues and recycling and stuff, and which is, you know, frankly, a bullshit argument, because, you know, if, you know,
Byron York made a bullshit argument, you are kidding me.
Yeah, I know. It's like you stop the presses. But I mean, it's a, you know, as I tried to point out today, you can be a Nazi who worries about transportation policy and recycling is still a Nazi, right? I mean,
a
racist who supports a basic, you know, income policy or is concerned about college debt is still a racist. I mean, there's not, and especially in the current era where it does seem to where our politics is kind of a, you know, ideological Mad Libs, where it's like, okay, I'm a Trumpian, but I'm against free trade and I'm for this and I'm for that. I mean, you know, they mix and match all the time here. So let's talk about this whole issue of white nationalism, because I know that Andrew, you're interested in this and been working on a piece. Is there a distinction, a meaningful distinction between the words white supremacy and white nationalism? And, you know, what is your reaction to the number of Democratic candidates who have either already accused Donald Trump of being a white supremacist or are under tremendous pressure to label the president as a white supremacist?
Yeah. So the first thing here is very simply, yes. I mean, they are differently shaded, essentially, ideologies. Someone who's a white supremacist essentially believes that, you know, the white race is, if, you know, insofar as you can call that a thing, has, you know, greater cognitive powers, greater abilities than other races in the world, and thereby have some sort of natural right to rule and should be, you know, should subjugate other races. And it's sort of this maximalist viewpoint. And obviously that's a similar thing to what what a white nationalist might believe. White nationalism being a slightly blurrier ideology, where you know it can white nationalism can ascend to the level of white supremacy. It can also sort of be a slightly more restrained ideology, where it essentially says, you know, it isn't that whites, you know, have you know this greater natural ability or this sort of almost like quasi God-given right to rule or anything like that. It's just that, you know, this country we've got here is a white nation and should remain a white nation probably, and we should take steps to ensure that we are not, you know, replaced by other races coming in. So you can see how these ideologies sort of shade one another and
Does sound like a little bit of branding, but, though, too. I mean, there's a little bit of branding going on there.
Absolutely, but so the
I'm not a Nazi, I'm a nationalist.
Yeah, I mean, and there is that. So, but maybe the more interesting question as far as these Democrats coming out and calling Trump a white supremacist himself is concerned is, at least from where I'm sitting, it seems like a little bit of a blunder. It seems like it's perhaps unintentionally framing the debate in a way that is easier for Trump to sort of equivocate on and wriggle out of.
Because,
the primary thing is that it sort of takes the focus off of these specific actual sort of criminal acts or these rampant ideologies in themselves that Trump has encouraged or you know given air to by his actions, right? Instead of focusing on those things, it tries to sort of peer into his brain, and it becomes this sort of speculative exercise on can we read into, you know, things that Trump has said and done and sort of make this pronouncement about the state of his mind, right? And this can lead us into some sort of crazy directions. We were talking a little bit before the show about you know, commentators on MSNBC or whatever speculating that Trump doing some specific actions on August 8th might be sort of whites a wink and a nod to two other white supremacists out there, because 8 is like I guess like an important number to some white supremacists, because the 8th
I don't want to
break anybody's brain, but so the bottom line is just this. The bottom line is that whether or not Trump is actually a white supremacist, whether or not he embraces that ideology, that seems kind of unlikely to me, just because Trump's not an ideological guy, right? I mean, he's sort of reactive. He goes by his gut and by his instincts. And white supremacy, if nothing else, you know, say what you will about it, at least it's an ethos.
Well, I mean, you can say that he is not a white supremacist. I mean, he may be a racist, but yeah, I think, look, I mean, am I reading your point correctly here? That whatever Donald Trump is, what's most important is how he behaves and the effect of his actions.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And without ever diving into that tangled web of Donald Trump's psyche, what we can do is step back and say, this is a man who's behaving in such a way as to encourage, enable, and expand the reach of people who, in fact, are racist and have a racist agenda.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Because at the end of the day, does it really matter whether Donald Trump is doing these things because he's motivated by this you know sincerely evil ideology, or whether he's just motivated by sort of political greed?
No, I get that. That's a good point. So when he stands there when they say send her back, is it because he is a white nationalist or a white supremacist, or because he's just cynically thinking this is going to help send a message to blue collar voters in Michigan? You know, at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter because the effect is what it is. Sarah, what's your take on this?
My biggest take is that if, you know, let's say it was an accident, right? He didn't really mean to be acting sort of like a white nationalist or fanning the flames of this ideology. Well, then when people pointed out to him that this was happening and that it seemed to be giving air to a lot of hate groups, what would a normal person do? What would a decent person do? They'd stop. They change their tone. If you were 3 days out from a shooting like this, wouldn't you not attack a former legislator from that district? Wouldn't you just restrain yourself just that tiny little bit? But he has no interest in that. I mean, I didn't get a chance to comment on the teleprompter thing, but I couldn't believe that anybody received that with anything other than skepticism. I mean, he was this sniffing, squinting robot clinging to that teleprompter for dear life. There's not a part of him that was lit up by that, except for the part where he started talking about the death penalty. Then you saw just a bit of animation from him. You know, there was no way that he meant it, and didn't take long to see that, of course, he didn't mean it.
Yeah,
he's never once done anything resembling any of those teleprompted remarks off the cuff in any way. I mean, that's all there is to it,
yeah,
right? I mean,
that's not who he is.
After one of these tragedies, you will always eventually see him get up and read off, you know, the totemic remarks that all of his fans point to forever after and say, no, see, obviously you're just ignoring this. But Trump is not a guy who hides his thoughts about things, right? I mean, if Trump had these feelings about white supremacists, he would tweet about them every once in a while. You know, he would go after them extemporaneously. He has no problem with taking shots at people who he dislikes, people he thinks he doesn't want around or doesn't need around, and he just never does, and he never will, and we all know this. And so it's just sort of tiring to have to do the whole, you know, song and dance every time, right?
But we have to do it every time. So this is a little bit of a digression here, but it was something that I was thinking about the other day, watching, you know, listening to his comments, watching his behavior, and just reviewing his conduct, you know, whether it's with women or with minorities, just et cetera, that there is literally, and I seriously mean literally, no public company in America that would hire Donald Trump for any executive position, right? At this point, would anyone hire him to be a producer of a television show, a movie show? Would you hire him for, you know, any job of actual responsibility? And yet he's able to get away with it because he's the president of the United States. So we're at this weird moment of inversion where our standard of behavior for the president of the United States is now lower than for, I would say, the vast majority of jobs in this country that require any sort of character or judgment.
Yeah, well, and it, I guess it depends a little on who the you is that's making the hiring decisions. I mean, if President Trump finishes out his tenure and, you know, wants a primetime gig on One America News or something like
yeah.
that, I imagine he's going to get it.
Okay,
right?
One America News, but do you think he's going to be on the board of directors of any publicly traded company in America?
Oh, that doesn't seem very
No,
likely.
It doesn't. Okay, so I want to just deal with some other, because there are some really, really tricky issues that are out there, including whether or not this Kabuki dance about guns is going to end up differently than any of the other Kabuki dances about guns, and also about how we feel about what Joaquin Castro did earlier this week, quote-unquote doxing some of the Trump contributors and this growing movement to boycott these health clubs because the owner, in fact, is hosting a high dollar fundraiser for Donald Trump. But first, we want to let's take a break. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do. And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Andrew Egger and Sarah Longwell. Okay, I want to avoid talking about guns for as long as possible because I hate talking about this issue, and I've said this over and over again. So give me your take, though. About the Castro doxing. And here you have this congressman who is the brother of the presidential candidate, easily confused, But he actually published, he tweets out a list of local constituents who had maxed out their contributions to Donald Trump. And there was a lot of blowback to that, saying this certainly does not help the political environment. It's pouring kerosene, because what you're basically saying is you're asking people to harass them because of their politics. Sarah Longwell.
Yeah, I thought the judgment on that was terrible. I mean, not only were these his constituents, I mean, people, you know, from his state, it just showed, I thought, a real tone deafness to, I mean, everything that we're talking about right now is how things are feel like a powder keg. Somebody has just walked into a Walmart and shot a bunch of people over politics and political ideology. And so as a politician, you have a special responsibility to de-escalate, to ratchet things down. And I think anybody who leans in and tries to escalate or target people in that moment, I just think the judgment is terrible. And honestly, I thought Julian Castro should have done something about Joaquin and said, look, you can't be chairman of the campaign. I thought he should have had some real consequence.
Let me push back a little bit. Please, devil's advocate with you, because these are public documents. These are public statements. Let's now switch to I don't have his name in front of me. I should. The guy that is the owner of these health clubs, that's holding the Hamptons fundraiser, the $250,000 a head fundraiser. There are people who are saying, listen, you know, if that's what you're going to do, I'm not going to join your health club. I'm not going to join SoulCycle. I'm not going to join Equinox. That's certainly their right as well, right? I mean, shouldn't there be some sort of consequences for people who've decided that they are going to provide major financial support for what some folks think is this reckless white nationalism?
So I hear what you're saying, Charlie.
Well, I get that. Giving you the argument, yeah.
Yeah, I get that there is an argument there that's, you know, worth addressing. I'm totally with Sarah on this, and I think the point she alluded to right at the beginning is maybe the big one for me, that the issue here is not necessarily that these, you know, weren't publicly available documents. It's not like it was a violation of their privacy rights or anything like that. The bigger issue for me is the issue of sort of the local community and the national community. And obviously, you know, everything's so screwed up on sort of the level of national political discourse right now, that it just seems like a real, almost like act of aggression for any particular person to sort of take a group of people, you know, from his own local community and sort of throw them out into the I'll say that again because of the noise. It just seems kind of pathological for any sort of local, regional political figure to take a group of people from their own, you know, local community and sort of throw them out into this just sort of howling monsoon of instability and bad faith talking and all this sort of things. And that, I mean, that's with all of our politics sort of pushing in that direction already, in terms of, you know, being more and more nationally focused, more and more dysfunctional at the national level, and sort of paying less and less attention to the places where things actually are capable of sort of happening in a useful and helpful way in these sort of local communities, it seems like an act of violence almost against that, against the idea of that sort of locality thing at all.
Okay, so by the way, the real estate developer's name is Stephen Ross, who's the owner of Equinox and SoulCycle, and Ross was holding this, planning to hold this fundraiser for the president and in the Hamptons, and so basically you have a lot of politically minded fitness nuts, that's the word from Slate Magazine, venting their anger on Twitter and vowing to boycott the chains.
To me, that's totally different and fine.
Right.
Like, I mean, it is a form of political speech to not. I mean, if people don't want to eat at Chick-fil-A and people don't want to go to SoulCycle, because I mean, I'm certainly going to use it as an excuse not to go to SoulCycle. I don't need to get my sweat on now. It feels great. That's a perfectly legitimate form of political speech. And honestly, if just a regular person, like, I think the difference is you got to look at both who the person was who tweeted and the context in which they tweeted. So you've got an actual legislator of his own constituents with a massive following and a huge megaphone going after people in an environment where things are incredibly tense. And so I'm just saying, like, as a judgment, as a responsible thing to do, it was irresponsible and showed very bad judgment. But, you know, I don't know. I think part of it too is like the barbecue joint there. I wonder how many bomb threats they got that day. You know, how many death threats came in over the phone. Now, I think people saying like, I'm not going to visit your gym is a pretty like benign form of political speech.
And it's a personal decision, right? I mean, it's because you know, each individual person knows that they're sort of responsible for their own conduct. You know, if you find out that you're sort of associating with someone whose views you disagree with, you think are morally wrong or whatever, you know, it's one thing to sort of remove yourself from that as sort of a conscientious act, and it's maybe not necessarily worse, but at the very least sort of a different calculation to throw that information out into the world where it comes across the eyes of tons and tons of people who you're not responsible for their conduct. You really have no control over what they do with that information, and you have to be more careful. It's a different calculation.
It does seem like that's going to be the new nature of politics as it becomes politics about politics all the time. Okay, let's finally talk about guns here. The headline in the Washington Post right now is Trump claims support for strengthening background checks at odds with GOP statements. And there are poll numbers out showing that rather strong majorities of folks favor bans on assault weapons. The support for universal background checks has always been just astronomical. There are now, there's a push for red flag laws that appears to have some bipartisan support. And I have no idea why Congress personally wouldn't pass some sort of regulation or limitation or ban on high capacity magazines. But either of you think that anything is actually going to get done this time? And let me just say, the reason I'm asking this is, you know, I mean, having seen this play before, I've become very, very cynical and kind of exhausted by it. And I guess my short answer is that if the massacre at Newtown of all those children, if that did not change the dynamic, didn't result in significant action, why does anyone think this will be different? But tell me why I'm wrong.
So the shooting at Parkland, I think about 18 months ago now, in the aftermath of that, I was pretty sure that something was going to happen. There did seem to be, you know, sort of like a 3-week period in there where Donald Trump seemed to have been sort of really moved by this incident. He was, you know, making unfamiliar noises for a Republican president about, you know, not being sort of cowed by the NRA, all these lawmakers and things like that. I mean, and, you know, did move the ball a little bit on things like bump stocks. Briefly there, and it seemed as though there was going to be movement, and we really have not even seen that level of sort of, we're going to try to roll up our sleeves and do something here after this, like we did after Parkland. It's almost as though people are just sort of playing out their ordinary sort of ritualized political responses, and there really hasn't been. I mean, I could be wrong about this. You know, we could see something like this materialize in the days ahead. But at least so far, I've sort of been taken by how little it seems like anything has changed on any side.
Let's game this out, Sarah. The argument is that the NRA is really weakened. It's got all the scandals. They are distracted. They are divided. And Trump does have this unique ability to make the Republican Party turn on a dime. Nixon goes to China on steroids. So if he stands up and says, you know what, by God, we are going to ban these assault weapons, which he's not going to do. We're going to have these background checks. We're going to do all this stuff, that whatever the NRA might be thinking, they would be forced to go along with it. So there is that potential that he would do this. Is that likely to happen?
I think that Donald Trump we saw this the last time when he met with all those Democratic senators. There was that bipartisan meeting, and he totally threw the NRA under the bus and said, like, yes, standalone bills, let's get something done. And he got yanked back. That was one of the ways you really saw the sort of NRA establishment pull him. But the fact is, there's two things going on that I think just could change the political calculus. One, not just the NRA is weakened, but Trump is now in the crosshairs where a lot of people are calling him a white supremacist. Like, he may be looking for some little concession to give people to, like, call off the dogs, depending on how this goes. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Mitch McConnell is under intense pressure right now on a couple of different fronts. On election security post the Mueller hearing, where he's got a ton of bipartisan bills in front of him to do something about the elections. He's been refusing to bring any of them to the floor to allow any debate on them. And now there's going to be a bunch of gun legislation that is also going to come up. And it's so point, he's going to have to make a choice between doing something, I think. And I think if he had to choose, he would go with guns because the president would be less angry at him for doing a little something on guns than he would on election security, which the president hates because it tacitly acknowledges that Russia is interfering with our election and that he may not be a legitimate president.
Yeah, but see, here's my hot take of the moment, which I'm prepared to change. It seems to me to be extremely unlikely that he will do anything to, you know, put himself crossways with the base at all. But if Republicans really are panicked about what's going to happen to them in the suburbs, if there really is growing anxiety that they are way on the wrong side of this, they might do something. But, or turn it around, if they did do something substantive, it would be an indication of how profoundly worried they are about the changing political landscape. Because up until now, it's been all base all the time. You must have, you know, you have no margin for error whatsoever. You have to turn out absolutely every single angry gun owner in America. And, you know, any sort of compromise that would, you know, demotivate them would be just forget it. But, you know, if in fact Republicans are looking at one another and going, look at these numbers. You know, you got 90% support for the background check. You got 70% support for a ban on, you know, on assault weapons, which, by the way, is not going to happen. They might do something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why the background checks to me seems like a very easy, like, pawn to give up in sacrifice and in service to sort of saying that looking like you've done something just because the public support is higher than 90%, which means that, like, most gun owners are supportive of background checks. The only people who are against background checks are the slippery slopers at the NRA who say you cannot give an inch on this.
So on a scale of 1 to 10. Yeah, sure.
Well, can I just ask one thing about we're talking about this assault weapons ban, right? And I mean, like, this is a thing that gets you know, a lot of times Republicans come under fire for protesting about these assault weapons bans, that they're kind of meaningless, they're sort of cosmetic, and all of these things. I've never really understood that argument. I've never really understood why the notion that this is not a meaningful category of weapons is a bad argument. Do you get what I'm saying? Like it doesn't seem like hair splitting. It feels like a hair splitting argument. It has, like, the characteristics of a hair splitting argument, but it seems like a kind of important distinction, right? I mean, like, that there is no real, like, class of weapons called that is an assault weapon. I mean, am I crazy here?
Well, that's right. I mean, and this is something I've had this conversation for years and years and years, that the terminology is often misused, you know, particularly when, you know, you find out that a lot of people don't understand what the term semi-automatic means. Semi-automatic, you know, it simply means that you have to pull the trigger each time and it will fire. But the reality is that there has to be a distinction between weapons of war and weapons that would be used for self-defense or hunting or anything else. There are weapons that are fundamentally more dangerous. There is a reason why in this country we have much harsher regulations for machine guns. I mean, imagine trying to ban machine guns right now. I mean, imagine this whole debate about machine guns. I mean, and the bump stock issue was interesting to the extent that it basically told people, you know, or reminded people or educated people, did you know that you can actually turn one of these weapons basically into a machine gun? And nobody had heard of bump stocks before that. So, yeah, it is distinction. But of course, that's not going to happen. We're not going to ban any of these things. It's going to come down to the red flag laws, background checks, you know, those kinds of things.
Right. So the only reason I bring it up is because, you know, there is this sort of cynical political gamification that we've all been talking about as far as, like, what Republicans may or may not do here. But I do think, you know, to be fair to Republicans, Republicans in this position, you know, whether or not they advance any of these things, and what they may end up choosing to advance is going to rely on, you know, what they actually think maybe stands a chance of actually being helpful in tamping down on these sorts of mass shootings, right? Which is why I think that maybe something like, you know, expand, and I guess I'm agreeing with you, Sarah, that expanded background checks, maybe a limit on high capacity magazines, potentially more likely than something like an assault weapons ban getting support from the Republican side.
Yeah, I agree. My prediction is nothing gets done.
Well, yeah.
Nothing gets done
to be a pretty safe prediction.
nothing gets done because ultimately folks will decide they'd rather have the issue than the solution. But again, it depends on the degree of panic. Okay, I sent you guys right before we started this this piece from the Washington Post Power Post, which basically talks about Charlie Cook, who has a new book out, The 2020 Almanac of American Politics, which is really the kind of the ultimate guide to American politics. And he sort of debunks this growing fear among Democrats that Trump is favored to win re-election. And, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, hand-wringing about this. You know, the economy is good. A lot of the fundamentals would suggest that he's in a strong position with the Electoral College. There have been those of us, like us, who've been concerned that the Democratic Party is going to lurch too far to the left. But Cook's point is that, no, despite all that, he's still an underdog, you know, and he runs through these factors. You know, the Hillary factor. You're not going to have somebody as toxic as Hillary around to kick around anymore. His approval ratings remain historically low and are somewhat immobile. The Electoral College, look, 2016 was the first time in 140 years a candidate won the popular vote by 2 points or more, but lost the Electoral College. So that was a fluke. It's unlikely that would be that Trump would be able to repeat that, according to Cook. Unforced errors, unlikely the Democratic nominee will make the same kind of mistakes fumbled by the Clinton campaign. Well, you never know about all of that. So he says there's about 20% of the electorate that is up for grabs, which means that in order to win the election, Trump still has to win somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of that 20% to stay within 3 points of a Democrat. And that's not going to be easy. And I just want to read you what Cook writes. While he's perfected the art of talking to his base, he seems unwilling or unable to reach or even talk to those beyond that base, those situated between his core support and the opposition camp. When the U.S. unemployment rate hit a 49-year low in April 2019, Trump's approval rating barely moved. Okay, he's still the incumbent. Economy is great. Major Democratic food fight going on. But is Donald Trump still an underdog? What do you think, Sarah? You do this for a living. What do you think?
I think it's 100% dependent on who the Democratic nominee is.
I agree with that, by the way.
And here's the thing. Like, I find these breakdowns not particularly useful in the sense that you got to show me the numbers in 6 states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, Arizona, Florida, and North Carolina, because I don't care if he's 29 points up in California. Like,
right.
The Electoral College is a thing. That's what matters. And so, you know, if the nominee is Elizabeth Warren, there's going to be a ton of people who are going to tell pollsters, yeah, I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump. And then they're going to walk into a booth and they're going to vote for him for a wide variety of reasons, not to mention that she does have incredibly radical policies. At the end of the day, a lot of these suburban women do not want their private health insurance taken away. And so I think that it is going to be entirely candidate dependent. And the other thing that I'll say about these types of analyses that are meant to sort of soothe Democrats is, like, that's the wrong posture. Sorry, guys, stay mad, like, stay ready. You should dance like nobody's watching, and you should run like you're always 10 points behind, because the thing that people, I think, and I didn't necessarily agree with his analysis about Hillary Clinton, because I think it's not just that she was historically unpopular, because he was sort of even more historically unpopular. The thing was, is that everyone thought she was going to win. There was not a sense of urgency. And so lots of people stayed home, not because they didn't like her, but because they just thought it was a foregone conclusion that she was going to win. And Democrats should not make the mistake of getting comfortable for 1 second going into this election. They should nominate the safest candidate, and then they should act like that candidate's behind the entire time.
Andrew.
I buy every word of that. I have nothing to add.
I do too. I just, you know, this is the thing is I think it is completely candidate dependent. And I'm sorry I get beat up for this, but I keep thinking about Richard Nixon in 1972. In 1971, it was not a foregone conclusion that he was going to be reelected, much less that he was going to win 49 of 50 states. So what do the Democrats do? They nominate somebody who was so far to the left that he basically turned off the entire center and even much of the traditional Democratic constituencies. I'm not saying that Ed Muskie or Hubert Humphrey would have beaten Richard Nixon, but it would not have been anything like what happened. And now, with the state of our politics, the weaponization of our politics, it matters tremendously who that candidate is. Okay, that was going to be my last question, but I'm seeing all of this this hand wringing now. And I really honestly don't know what you guys are going to say about this, about the quote-unquote gaffes by Joe Biden. And people are worried, you know, okay, Joe Biden keep making all these gaffes and apparently said something that was impolitic in – look, if I can find this, which I can't. Iowa.
He was making a speech and he basically was trying to talk about how they're – you know, sort of an achievement gap and things like that, and he basically said poor kids are just as smart as white kids. Yeah.
That's racist.
It's not a great thing to say. He sort of immediately realized that he had he'd flubbed, and he tried to throw out a bunch more categories to basically just be like, know what I mean.
Okay, on a scale of 1 to 100, as a gaffe, that strikes me as a 1.5. This strikes me as
on a 1 to 100 scale.
This is like Romney in the Binders Full of Women scale of actual gaffes.
I don't know if I agree with that. It was a cringy moment. I say that thinking the Romney thing was just kind of mean to Romney. It was just like not a very fair attack. And this was like, okay, so clearly Joe Biden associates sort of rich kids with white kids, poor kids with black kids. It's not your ideal thing for a presidential candidate to say. That's all I'm saying. Okay. It was a gaffe. Yeah, it was an embarrassing gaffe.
If gaffes and lack of lucidity was a disqualifying factor, we wouldn't be having this conversation today because Donald Trump wouldn't be president.
I am not arguing with that.
Hey, you know, Charlie, it's funny. I think you do something, and I think we do something that a lot of people aren't doing, which is that we use the same metric for a Joe Biden and a Donald Trump. But the fact is, most of the media doesn't. Most of the public doesn't, because Donald Trump is such a weird character and a reality show star and a total psycho all the time. People just like put him in his own category, and normal political rules don't apply to him. But when you get these Democrats, they will have to still live under normal political rules. And when they make gaffes, people are going to make fun of them, and they will in no way ever equal one another, but everyone will pretend like they do.
So that's a reason why Democrats, don't get to sort of just throw up their hands and be like, well, you don't care when Trump does this, because people don't care when Trump does it. But you still, I mean, if anything, that just means you have to play cleaner baseball than you would otherwise, okay, right? I mean, it's not fair, but that's the reality of the situation.
Let me play sort of stereotype talking head, since I do this, which is that this is one of the advantages that Grandpa Biden has, that he's Grandpa Biden and the people know him. And that people are going to cut him some slack on some of this stuff. That there's something real about him, and I think that he's going to get more slack for this stuff than some of the younger, less known candidates. I just think it's going to play out that way because he's been around so often, and so people are going to roll their eyes about they will say these impolitic things once in a while, but I don't think any of them are going to be fatal. And I guess as the evidence of that, I'm going to point to the fact that all of the hits he's taken don't seem to have shaken his numbers that much. Although there's no question that Elizabeth Warren is quote unquote surging, but it's early August, and you know what that means, right? That it's early
August.
Tell
us what that means.
It means it's early August. It means it's freaking early August. That's all it means. It's just like we're going to be talking about this. You understand that a year from now, we're still going to be talking about presidential politics?
Amazing. I love
it. Makes you, yeah, makes you want to go, you know, stick your head in a bucket of cold water or something, or something like that.
Can I say one at least countervailing point to what you were saying just there, Charlie? Because I do agree with your analysis in general. One complicating thing about this might be that there's a difference in perception. At least it seems to me that there is likely to be a difference in perception between sort of the like aw shucks, what are you gonna do kind of hapless Joe Biden thing that he's been doing for years and years, pretty much his whole career, and the situation that he's in now, where when he makes a gaffe like this, he immediately has to sort of like furiously backpedal and sort of apologize and double and triple down on the fact that he wasn't trying to say anything bad. And it's possible that the perception of that does not reflect as favorably on him, just given this sort of sprint he has to do sort of to cover his tracks after every one of these sorts of things.
You're right.
So much more pressure on him, right?
Sure. This was not my analysis. This was my knee-jerk reaction.
This was my knee-jerk
early August reaction, where I'm never going to be held that accountable for it. So I can throw this shit up against the wall and whatever. the other thing though that to actually, you know, support your point here, and I hate to give Trump credit for anything, but you know, when he throws out these sort of memes and narratives, you know, like, you know, Sleepy Joe. There's going to be that focus on, is Joe too old? Has Joe lost a step? Is Joe, you know, just, you know, and so that will be exaggerated, because I remember very distinctly during the 26 campaign how intense the speculation was about Hillary's health. And I think in retrospect, you know, most of it was just, you know, pure, you know, propaganda and hoax, but it had an effect. So, you know, that moment when she stumbled, I mean, if Joe Biden in September of 2016 has a moment where he stumbles getting into a car like Hillary did, it's going to be a bigger deal than it ought to be, because, you know, the Trump and his lackeys are going to make this a narrative that he's too old, he's too slow, he's too sleepy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you're probably right about that, Andrew. Andrew Egger and Sarah Longwell, thank you for extending your Fridays, because I know that in Washington, D.C., there's like nobody around after noon on a Friday in August.
Not
Is that
in this
right,
office,
Sarah?
My friend. Not in this office. Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to The Bulwark. Today's podcast was brought to you by 8Sleep. I'm Charlie Sykes. I will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.